Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Okay, well, welcome back. Everyone had a good sit. I'm going to go around now and just say our names, get to know each other a little bit better, at least on that level. David.
Douglas.
Randy.
Bob.
Mike.
Scott.
My name is Jim.
George.
Peter.
Buzz.
Peter.
Pop.
Larry.
Jack.
Seth.
John.
Barb.
Francis.
Jay.
Paul.
Steve.
Cliff.
Well, our speaker today is Larry Yang, who's been with GBF for a long time. In the early days, and back today to talk with us. He's a Spirit Rock community Dharma leader and leads meditation retreats tailored for men, people of color, the LGBTQ communities, and people in recovery from addiction. He co-leads a meditation group for the LGBTQ community in San Francisco and is a psychotherapist and consultant in cultural competency.
Thank you.
First of all, thank you for having me speak. It's when Clint called me, it was just such a joy to be invited back into this space because this not only is this space just a loving place to practice, but really this place was one of my Dharma gates in terms of really becoming familiar and finding a community to practice in. And so that actually sort of led to what I'd like to talk about. But before I actually get into that, I'd like to share that one of the things that I share with my partner is that over the years we've developed this interaction that we're little boys together, that you know, sometimes we'll go into these ways of talking with each other that are sort of childlike, or that we'll sort of hit each other, or sort of spar, or verbally, or wrestle, or play games with our words, make fun of each other and stick out our tongues. Whatever it is that you can think of, around being little boys, I raise it because what we realized after a couple of years is that this is the experience we didn't have. That when we were little boys, we didn't have that comfort with, another gay man or a gay boy, or and we're just actually trying to incorporate that energy back into our lives. I mean, it doesn't prevent us from being adults, but just to include that could be this sense of just directness and innocence sometimes that comes with that energy. So I'm actually going to begin my talk with quoting from the Dharma of Dr. Seuss. I bet you guys there didn't know that he wrote some Dharma. So this is called The Zax. One day, making tracks in the prairie of Prax, came a north-going Zax and a south-going Zax. It happened that both of them came to a place where they bumped. There they stood, foot to foot, face to face. Look here now, the north going Zach said, I say, you're blocking my path. You're right in my way. I'm a north going Zach, and I always go north. Get out of my way now, and let me go forth. Who's in whose way, snapped the south-going Zax. I always go south, making south-going tracks. So you're in my way, and I ask you to move, and let me go south in my south-going groove. Then the north-going Zax puffed his chest up with pride. I never, he said, take a step to one side. And I'll prove to you I won't change my ways if I have to keep here standing 59 days. And I'll prove to you, yelled the south-going Zax, that I can stand here in the prairie of Prax for 59 years, for I live by a rule that I learned as a boy back in south-going school. Never budge, that's my rule. Never budge in the least, not an inch to the west, not an inch to the east. I'll stay here, not budging. I can and I will. If it makes you and me and the whole world stand still. Well, of course the world didn't stand still. The world grew. In a couple of years, a new highway came through. And they built it right over those two stubborn sacks and left them there standing unbudged in their tracks. I start with that because this aspect of feeling different or being different or having that sensation of being separate has been such a common thread in my practice wherever I've gone. And even today, I mean, you know, with what's happening in the world and what's happening in New York and the conventions, and you know, this feeling of difference and separation is very pervasive, and also this feeling of difference, I think, is pervasive in our own experience as gay men, because on some level it's where we begin. We begin to become aware of something that was different. I didn't even have a word for it when I was sort of pre-teens. But this feeling of not relating to others in the exact same way, this initial awareness that we have come to call, whatever we call it, you know, as gay people, as queer folks, and it really called to me to explore what is this direct experience of difference when it arises. What is the direct contact of our senses and our emotions and our thoughts? Because that's what our mindfulness asks us in each moment of our experience. What is it really that we're experiencing? And so, as this exploration of difference and what it really meant to me, there are some stories that began to unfold for me that really were illuminating around what this feeling of difference was. And I'll share one is that about 10 years ago, I was one of the providers at the Tom Waddell Health Clinic downtown in the transgender clinic. And it was my first, I was there for a couple of years, and that was my first position there. And I had people in my own life that had identified as transgender, but I actually had never come into contact with the community at large in terms of what transgender issues were at the time. And there was some nervousness around my part because I didn't identify as transgender, and I knew that my conception of my gender identity was different. And there was anxiety. And so I began meeting with people that I was working with. And I remember one particular person who flowed into the room that we were in, and we had our discussion. And at the end of our time together, this person said, "Larry, you are either the butchest femme or the femmest butch I have ever met." And they said it with such graciousness, this opening into ambiguity, that it just relaxed my own defenses. And it was quite a healing moment, because it was an acknowledgement of difference. I mean, very strong difference, and the ability to be in the same moment together, as opposed to this linear experience that I sometimes have, and maybe you have too, that when one feels different, that linearly it leads to the experience of separation or injury or harm. But actually, this experience of difference led to quite a healing moment that opened my own experience to a community that I had not really been in contact with. I also remember there was, I don't know how many people are familiar with with sort of the landscape in the Southwest, but there are all these red rock canyons in sort of northern Arizona and southern Utah. And I wanted to hike this one particular canyon called Antelope Canyon, which is this slot canyon. And it's been photographed a lot. It's this curvilinear shape with the sun coming in, and it's absolutely spectacular. But in order to get there, because it's on the Navajo Rez, the Dine Reservation, you had to go with a guide. So I got in this truck, and this guy looked at me, and I could sense that he was trying to place me. And he said, "So what tribe are you from?" And you know, there was a little bit of anxiety on my part, because I didn't know whether to say so that we would feel separated, or I wanted to feel connected with him. And so I said, "I'm not, native, I'm Chinese." And without blinking an eye, he said, "Oh, well, you know that we all came from the same place." And he started to talk about his extended family, and we started to share the similarity of how some of our extended family relationships are. And so again, this feeling of difference actually did not lead to a experience of separation. It actually led to a feeling of more connection within our diverse experiences. And then there's, of course, those experiences that exist too many times in the world, in which we come across a difference, and just like these guys who stand there face to face, there is absolutely no coming together. Last summer, it was quite recently, I was going to meet a friend for dinner, and I stopped at the B of A teller on the corner of 9th and Irving, and I was really impatient, and I was waiting for the people to get their money in. I walked up to the teller, and then I just froze in front of the teller, because there was all this anti-Asian graffiti written over it, really sort of hate language. And just noticing how that triggered all of the other historical stuff that I hold in my body and my emotions, and feeling that withdrawn, that wanting wanting the world to go away because it was too painful. And so, of course, there's that difference, experience of difference that leads to injury and separation. But actually, when I see it in context with the other experiences that I was sharing with you, there's this permeability around difference, that difference does not lead to anything that we can predict. It can lead to actually experiences that are quite healing, and they can lead to experiences that are really alienating or injurious. And, you know, just to look on the flip side of that also, that's the same thing when we feel similar with something. I mean, the linear association is that when I feel connected or something in common with you, that that's going to be a positive experience. But I can say, I think pretty honestly, the people that I am most genetically and biologically similar to are my parents. And that similarity is what kept me in the closet for them for 36 years, because disrupting that unity was oppressive. It was oppressive to me. And it wasn't a healing experience, because I couldn't say within that context, look, I'm different, or to really have space within that sense of commonality. And then, you know, there are those experiences within, you know, our shared commonality. For example, I when I first started, I said that this group was my Dharma gate. I had sat with a lot of different groups in terms of my meditation, trying to learn what the Dharma was, what meditation was, how to integrate it. And feeling that difference in mainstream retreats was an obstacle for me. And it took a space like this for me to begin to just relax not just my emotions, but also my body, because our sitting practice is such a physical experience too. And really, the greatest opening for me were the queer residential retreats that Eric Kovic and Irina Weissman do, and the retreats, the September retreats that GBF does, that really allowed me to feel connected to the practice. So, again, there's this there's this awareness that even feeling common with people doesn't necessarily produce the same outcome. It could be a really healing experience, or it could be quite the opposite. And then, you know, just turning our mindfulness practice, as opposed to thinking that we know what we're experiencing, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, but just turning it so that we're looking a little bit deeper into what's happening. For example, that incident that I was in front of the ATM and felt really separate from the world and in pain. What I was able to do was really to connect with what was happening in my body. And as I really took in the people that were walking around, because it's in a fairly Asian neighborhood, and you know, I just connected with the suffering that other people were experiencing, seeing this sort of hate graffiti. And what was quite liberating for me in that moment was in sitting with the suffering of others that were, that may have seen this or that I imagined would come into contact with when they were going up to the timeless teller, is how injured that person must have been to actually execute that event. And so in the middle of this withdrawal, in the middle of this wanting the world to go away, then there was this feeling of connection with the perpetrator. It was pretty complex. And realizing that our real experience of the moment has so many layers to it. And in that moment of seeing that connection with the perpetrator, it didn't prevent me from doing what, just because I felt connected with him and felt sorry for him or whatever I was feeling, didn't prevent me from doing what I felt I needed to do. So I contacted the Asian Law Caucus. I knew that Carolyn had done a piece on anti-Asian graffiti in the past, so I contacted them to let them know that it was happening. But the liberating part of the practice is as you connect on these multiple levels, there's also this natural letting go, that we are doing the best that we can, and that in seeing both and, the both and, as opposed to the either or of the injury of the interaction, is this letting go that I did what I did, and the experience didn't stick. There was no need to revisit the experience. And the revisiting of the injury is what actually creates trauma. It's this intrusive, uncontrolled entrance of these reoccurring thoughts around injury. And so that letting go from that actual feeling of connection was quite a extraordinary experience. And so when we start to look at this experience of difference, just like the Zecs, you know, they're stopped in their tracks. But how similar are they? They're exactly the same. You know, and I wonder how to hold, you know, the some of the political struggles we're going through these days that are such solidified differences, and yet there's such a commonality in how some things are being expressed. So as we look into difference, we find actual quite a lot of similarity. And, you know, as I said before, as we look into the similarity, as I look into the similarity with those people that I feel most connected to, whether it's my family or my friends, I begin to find differences that are just differences. So there are there's this experience of difference, and there's this experience of connection. And the weight that we put to it comes from the space of I. It really only takes on weight when there's an ego for it to revolve around. Otherwise, it's just another conditioned reality. It's just things that happen in the world. But if it's that I am different than you, and the meaning that I attach to that, or if you are the same to me, and therefore there are other people that are different from us. You know, it revolves around this place of ego. And the Buddha said directly that this is not helpful, and this does not lead to liberation. He said, a bhikkhu, a monk, or in this case, someone who practices, should not present himself as equal to, i.e. the same as, or imagine himself to be inferior or better than himself. So that's what happens when we feel different. We either feel inferior or better than. And The teaching is that this does not lead to liberation. Just that thought does not lead to liberation. It's simply another set of conditions in our world. And the way that the traditional teachings have framed it, that there are eight worldly conditions. There's pain and pleasure, there's fame and disgrace, there's gain and loss, and there's praise and blame. And all of us go through all of those worldly conditions. You know, there's say, in your workplace, you put out a memo that you think is really well fashioned, and you're doing some good. It's not going to, there's always going to be some criticism about it from some aspect. So there's always, whatever we do in our life, there's always going to be an aspect of praise and blame. People who gain a lot of material wealth, it's not necessarily a guarantee that they have happiness, and they lose in another aspect in their lives. Likewise, that when we gain sort of that emotional stability, it doesn't mean that it's going to last. So the impermanence of these worldly conditions is really what the teachings are pointing us towards. I do a lot of diversity training in my work, a lot of stuff around cultural competency, and this is a pretty emotionally laden area. And so there was a situation in which I was preparing to do a training for an organization, and I was brought in by a few allies, people that I was quite connected to. And the organization was going through this complete upheaval. You know, like the board was in turmoil, the director, the executive director. And I said to not just the people that brought me in, but most of the organization, this is not the time to do diversity training. This is precisely not the time when there's a crisis to address these issues. And there's another process that needs to occur before we can get to sort of more open discussions around issues of culture and difference. And a part of the organization heard it and said yes. And a part of the organization, including the one key ally, who also was a queer person of color, was completely enraged that I would withdraw this contractual agreement. And my interaction with this one person was really quite there was a lot of rage in their response to me. And in that moment, I knew it wasn't this person. And I knew it wasn't me. It was just this energy of rage. And as opposed to going into me, I could sense it just going through. That ability to stand with this person in the rage. So that's the practice of compassion. That's the meeting the moment for what it is. There was also simultaneously a letting go. Of being attached to my view or their view, or that this is the actual experience of, whether you want to call it racism or oppression or internalized, whatever it was, that I'm not smart enough to figure out. I don't know if anybody is, but I am smart enough to just stay there. And the energy just moved. And we still have this connection, knowing that we had this disagreement. And in that space of sort of letting go of needing to be attached to a view, a sense of this is happening to me or this is being done by this person, there, it's not a letting go of an identity, or it's not even letting go of an opinion, because I still had an opinion. But there was a letting go to allow the space to include another perspective or other perspectives. So it's just this expansion as opposed to negation of any of our experiences. One of the most graphic images that has been told me around suffering is that suffering is like rope burn. It's, you know, our experience is constantly changing. The rope is being pulled through us. And our need to hold on to meaning or a sense of I is creating this friction that creates the rope burn. And so just letting go, as much as we can let go, Ajahn Chah, one of the Thai masters who is the teacher of many of our teachers, said that if you let go a little, you have a little bit of happiness. If you let go a lot, you have a lot of happiness. If you let go completely, you'll have complete happiness. The other thing, the other reason, and I want to save a little bit of time so that we can, you know, sort of talk about it, because again, everybody has a different experience, right? So you probably have a different experience of even what I'm saying, and that interests me to explore. This whole thing about feeling different from me, when I'm able to really become quiet with it, really points to another fundamental teaching, and that is that each moment of my experience is different. That that my mouth is drier than it was 5 minutes ago. That I'm not necessarily the same person right now that I was walking in. And it's that continual denial of that ongoing impermanence that allows me to be uncomfortable with the difference that's out there, the external difference. The more that I can come in tune with the differences that are happening on a momentary level, the more space I actually have to absorb the differences that are happening outside. Because actually, that's our deepest commonality that all of us are going through. And so, for example, can you sense the changes that you've gone through just listening to whether you've agreed with me or disagreed with me, and how sometimes it's shifted back and forth? And it's not anything to take too seriously. I mean, one of the suggestions is just to hold our experience lightly. That we just don't completely believe that in these opinions that we have. And we do these funny things around these teachings, like around impermanence. Sometimes there's this thing called more or less impermanence that we practice. Like it's easy to see impermanence if there's an ice cream cone in front of you, or if you're exercising and you sense that your body is getting tired. but is my mother ever going to change? why is that experience exempt from this law? And so it's this more or less selected impermanence that is part of the delusion that we perpetuate. And really, just to pick at it, you know, again, not to do anything else with it. This is such a perfect also area for exploration if you're on retreat. Because as the mind quiets, you just begin to notice how the mind works. I was in this 3-month retreat last fall, and this guy in front of me, whenever he bowed, he was like bowing about a foot into my space every single sitting. And, you know, at the first it was irritation. And then the stories started coming up. You know, like, he doesn't know how to practice. Where is he coming from? You know, and I was only looking at his feet, so then he became dirty. And, you know, it was just... After my mind got quiet enough, I saw what the mind was doing. It was just being irritated and different, and it wasn't anything else. And in that sort of noticing, that sort of stepping back and noticing, there was not the over-involvement with the story, and the story began to fall. And also the sense that of the sense of it revolving around somebody that it was happening to, that, you know, this guy was that of course the whole retreat was revolved around my level of comfort, that you know, we've had a the way that I sometimes like to talk about self and our delusion around self is that centuries ago we thought that the universe revolved around the Earth. And even today we have every physical evidence that the Sun revolves around the Earth. But we've had this Copernican revolution that we kind of know that even though every morning we see the Sun coming up east and going down in the west, that we've reoriented our understanding, and we know that we revolve around the sun. And it's this internal Copernican revolution that I haven't been able to, you know, that I still feel that the world revolves around something inside here. And that's part of my practice, is really to begin to create that revolution inside. So I'll end with two quotes. One is from the Buddha. That I've altered a little bit. I mean, with all due respect, when I do day-longs around recovery and addiction, I sort of admit to people that I've rewritten the 12 steps for Dharma practice. So just take it with a grain of salt. But anyway, the original passage from the Buddha is that this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. So what I've done is I've just inserted this experience of difference or commonality. When it comes up for me, I say, this difference or this similarity is not mine. This difference or similarity that I am not. This difference or similarity is not myself. I'll end with a quote from Suzuki Roshi, who was talking about sort of sometimes we are striving for this spiritual sense of oneness, this universality that is part of our inherent nature. But sometimes we do it to the exclusion of other experiences. So he writes, "Strictly speaking, there are no separate individual existences. There are many, just many names for one existence. Sometimes people put stress on oneness, but this is not our understanding. We do not emphasize any point in particular, even oneness. Oneness is valuable, but variety is also wonderful. Ignoring variety, people emphasize the absolute one existence, and this is one-sided understanding. In this understanding, there's a gap between variety and oneness. But oneness and variety are the same thing. So oneness should be appreciated in each individual existence." So we have a few minutes. I just wanted to open up for people to either share their thoughts or responses or anything that
your talk, I really appreciated all the things you said, brought up a huge number of things, but the one thought I'd like to share in a moment is the question about the mother not obeying the law of impermanence. And I relate to that very strongly. However, like the two backs on the road, I don't necessarily have to not obey the law of impermanence, and I can change how I react to that interaction. That's a lot of what you would say.
Yeah. And when I look at, you know, one of the things that His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, says is that when one looks at one's spiritual practice, it's not helpful to look at it over a couple of months, but really over decades and past there. And when I actually look at my relationship with somebody like my mother, it hasn't stayed the same. It's actually changed. And it's just that I keep pushing for more. You know, it's a attachment. And that inadequacy that it's not enough. And that is sort of more future-oriented, not staying in this present moment. Just be with what it is.
I love this theme of difference and similarity. And I noticed that perhaps our differences could be upsetting. But then look at you and the wall behind you, you're very different from the brick in the wall. And that difference doesn't upset
me. Thank you for that. I was struck by the brilliance of kind of finding a moral code in queerness. I like that. That's very nice. And as we're addressing power struggles all over the world, race and class and so on, it's awfully helpful to have a kind of queer perspective. I wanted to query a little deeper. Sometimes the energy went through you, either the difference or the similarity, and you did a really wonderful demonstration holding on a piece of paper, and it just fell away. And that kind of felt to me like untying karmic knots. And I wonder if that was a metaphor you use, or if you have any insight around the karma that we create in our lives.
I don't know if I have any insight around karma. I have a lot of experience with karma. But I don't know if I have any insight into it. And, of course, the Buddha said that if you think about karma too much, your mind's going to explode. So... there's that warning, so to speak. But it's for me, it's been really helpful to have a healthy sense of awe of karma. That there are times in which I feel, or the feeling comes up that karma has been changed. That I'll give you another example of this difference. And when karma changes, there's a healing experience for me usually. And another example is that I was sitting with my very best, closest friend, who's a woman in the East Bay. And there was a point in time in which I realized that she grew up Japanese American. She is Japanese American. And the contrast of, and we're exactly the same age, the contrast of having this close a relationship between a Chinese American and a Japanese American would not have happened even 40 years ago, half a generation, because of the huge conflict. And that moment was so powerful for me that karma had been changed, not through some striving, but really just through our own mutual openness to who we were. And that's not to say that, you know, when we talk about oppression and racism and xenophobia, there's, you know, there's a systemic institutional nature to it. But that was realizing the karma of the situation was realizing the change in that institutional experience, that as institutions, there was this story only last month in which soccer teams from Thailand and Japan played in Beijing, and they jeered and threw stuff at the Japanese team. So that the institutionally, as a collective, the energy is still caught. So just noticing when karma changes and how that is such a positive, can be such a positive experience. That I think the thing that I try to hold is that karma can change. Because the burden of karma seems sometimes to be irreversible, and if we start thinking like that, that just adds to the closet door or whatever is locking us into our past behavior. So it's just the openness to know that what the possibility and the potentials are.
I appreciated your talk very much. Just as a footnote, I think it was just this week that from the museum in Oslo, that Edvard Munch's picture of the screen was stolen. And I had seen that as a torment of a 19-year-old, and I really could hear the screen when I was in Oslo. And in fact, a friend brought me a copy of it. And when I heard that it had been stolen, I said, "Well, that's good. It's just too severe. It's too vivid. You know, it's too high. It just is. It's a depiction of the hell of a sense of complete separation and of no escape from that." And it touched me. It was like someone was trying to punish the picture. But I think that's to me what separation feels like. It feels like just a cosmic. So lurically painted, I was touched by the selection of that picture to be taken.
Well, we're getting close to time to close down. You'll be around, I guess, during the break to talk about that. Okay, so do we have any announcements?
Our new biggest announcement, but we're going to be having a booth at the Castle Street Fair. I see that on the Saturday.
fun. You interact with the gay community and promote your movie fun, Jim.
You made it sound like a zoo. That petting zoo.
And I'd like to take a chance to announce again, I'm starting a yoga class in Lower Haight, for focusing on people with carpal tunnel problems. So if you're interested in it or know someone who might be, I put a flyer out there and I'd be glad to talk to you about it.
Yes, George.
Yes, a reminder that these talks are available on the internet at the GBF website, gbuddhist.org.
And if anyone wants to volunteer to host the pop-up, they talk to me. Okay, so let's all get them. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. We've got our hosts here.
Well, somebody should remind you, encourage you to have tea or whatever, and there's some nice cookies. Do not leave any crumbs because the mice will eat and proliferate. Please wash your cups. Please leave some money, as much as you can. Who here is new? We have one new person. Yes. Afterwards, some people tend to go to lunch, and please feel encouraged to join. Okay. Let's see what else. What about you,
That's pretty good.
Kay isn't here to announce about the retreat, but there's a deadline for getting a $10 discount. It's, I think, September 1st. If you thought you were going to get it in.
And also, we have an opening on the host roster. I cast their careers once every 2 months, so if anybody's willing to do that, please see me.
Okay, so let's all. By the power and the truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity, without too much attachment or too much aversion, and live believing in the equality of all that lives. Thank you.
Thank you very so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.